Hello, everybody. Welcome back to North Idaho Now. This is episode 64 for September 10th. Chance Watson and Madison Hardy bringing you the news today. And this episode is brought to you by Hecla Mining Company. Hecla Mining Company is a leading low-cost silver producer with operating silver mines in Alaska, Idaho, and Mexico, and is a growing gold producer with operating silver mines in Quebec, Canada, and Nevada. They're the largest primary silver producer in the U.S., responsible for one-third of the silver produced in our nation. Their philosophy is to operate mines safely by promoting a deeply rooted value-based culture, leveraging mining skills developed over the company's long history, and by innovating new practices. To learn more about Hecla Mining Company, please visit HeclaMining.com. That was a mouthful. And I was also trying to find my coffee at the same time.
Yeah, you were struggling a little bit. I really like the deeply valued root-based almost.
Deeply value root-based, yes. The deeply rooted value-based culture. See, there's supposed to be a comma right there. Whoever put that script together, that was me. I did that. Those memes that are like, hate when people do this. I'm people. That's me.
Yeah. That's me.
I'm people. Yeah. Madison, what's going on?
Oh, you know, just going throughout the day. It's been a little cooler.
I appreciate it so much.
As like you always do.
Although it's cloudy and overcast out, and I love it.
Yeah, it has been nice. I mean, it was so hot for so long. It's nice to get a little reprieve. And obviously, we are going into the fall season. So.
Follow my logic on this. When it is like gloomy and cloudy out, there's almost like a little bit of more freedom that I have, because when it's so nice out, like I'm always tempted, like I want to go outside. I need to do something outside. I need to enjoy this sun. When it's bad out, the decision is made. I don't need to do that. There's no temptation. It's, oh, okay. Got it. Go home.
Free reign.
Right. Exactly. Indoor activities. Got it. Cool. Yes. So we actually have a pretty full episode today. We have a lot of headlines to go through.
It's been a busy news week.
It has been. Unfortunately, for those who do not want to hear about COVID stuff,
this is not the podcast.
This is not the episode for you. Or at least the Coeur d'Alene headlines. We're going to be diving into it deep. We'll have the latest on that kind of stuff going forward on it. And also, in addition to COVID stuff, we don't have any headlines about September 11th, do we?
We don't. I mean, I know that personally here at the coverage, at the press, we have a pretty static lineup for the weekend, talking about taking national news, talking to some of the locals about their experience with where they were, which actually leads into our cold open. We kind of wanted to talk about that from our perspectives. I personally was, only 3 years old.
Yes, you're when a it child. Happened. Got it.
And I was also out of the country. So I think I really enjoyed getting out and talking to people about, what...
Oh, yeah, you weren't an American yet.
I wasn't, although, my parents are both American-born.
Okay.
They spent the majority of their life here stateside.
Gotcha.
It was something that my mom told me that it was on every news station everywhere. It wasn't
just... Are you a
dual
citizen?
Yes, I have two passports.
That's super cool.
Yeah. But my mom said that she remembers watching it on the news when it happened. Mm-hmm. In the UK. Mm-hmm. But I did want to open up and see what your experience was.
Mine, so I was in either the third or fourth grade. I think it was the third grade. I remember my first time hearing about it, I was one of the honored few that were allowed to bring the attendance sheet back to the office after roll call was done.
You were.
I think it was more because I whined and complained, not that I had earned it. But in any case, I remember going back and the office staff had one of those old brown box TVs that every old elementary school has, or had rather. They've probably been phased out by now. But and they had it on. I remember it was a grainy old TV, probably from like the 80s, and they were watching the news on it, and it was set up in like the middle of the office. So it was definitely looked like this was a situation. I'm in third grade. It doesn't necessarily phase. I don't understand what's going on. I just know that, that's new and interesting. The fun fact, though, is that I always remember that, and then a lot of memories from that day, because at the time my parents were going through a custody battle for me, and the day that I was supposed to find out basically who I was going to live with was September 11th, 2001. The court hearing was obviously pushed out. Nothing was concluded that day, obviously. But I just remember that was because that was already an important day for me at the time, even before you know, September 11th, the terrorist attacks. So it was interesting. That was it definitely, I have memories of it for sure.
Yeah, when I was talking to people about it, I talked to one woman that was 40, mm-hmm. and then another that was 13 at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so the 40-year-old, you know, she said that she had just dropped her kids off at school. And it was just shocking to see for her, you know, she'd heard about it on the news when she was driving the car mm-hmm. and immediately went back home instead of going to work and just mm-hmm. sat there and watched the news. And then the 13-year-old, she was saying that she was a cheerleader mm-hmm. at the time for Lakes Middle School. Mm-hmm. And so her and her friend went to the gyms in the morning to mm-hmm. train and get fit and all that jazz. And they were on the treadmills just talking and laughing when suddenly every single screen in front of them just changed. And one thing that I have recepted from the situation as like an outsider looking in was that situations like this previously that had happened, you know, with the wars and mm-hmm. all that jazz, the media wasn't as much of a present force in the sense that, you know, you didn't have radios and TVs and newspapers and social media sites news. And website, you know, like, cable news was so new.
Cable news was, and it was big too.
It was big. And everyone, you know, everyone that we talk to here at the press.
Not that it isn't now, but I mean, there's multiple different forms of media now, whereas back then it was still, you were still limited.
Exactly. And so it was almost like at the same time, everyone found out about this. Mm-hmm. Everyone was watching the same TV runs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, previously, if something interesting, something intense like that would have happened, it would have been like mm-hmm. in the newspaper, you'd hear about it the next day or something like that.
I wouldn't get a cell phone for another 3-4 years.
Exactly. And so I think that was just such a crazy thing for me to hear it being such a prominent influence during that period. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, here we are, we honor it every year.
And it's interesting to hear from kids because they can almost look at it. It's a limited view, but it's also kind of like one that's almost, I don't want to say unbiased, but unburdened by like emotion. Like you can mm-hmm. kind of get this from like just your internal angst, because you don't understand, you know, you don't, especially if you don't live there or anything like that. Like, you know, because you're seeing adults, you know, that are, they're in, you're like, okay, this is a serious situation, but you don't, you know, I would assume that it's very similar to, you know, how kids are dealing with COVID now. Like, they don't fully understand the breadth of the severity of it. Like in fact, you know, if they're growing up in this right now, this is the norm. Like mm-hmm. it's not a huge thing. You know, that if you dealt with, you know, like great grandparents and grandparents, I've talked about this before kind of when we talked about vaccines, like vaccines to like my grandpa, who passed away, almost 2 years ago now, to the day, they were a huge breakthrough invention. Like, they were a good thing all around. Like, he got the flu shot every year and would never skimped on. I mean, he got as many as that he could all the time, because it's stuff that we take for granted now that was a revolutionary breakthrough at the time. So kind of going back, tying it all together, when you look at that with September 11th, you've got kids, adults, you know, they understand like, oh, this is a big deal. But as a kid who grew up, even as we went into the Iraq War and stuff, you know, it's something that's happening. But you kind of look at it as almost like a TV show, because it's so far away and mm-hmm. You're not an adult. You don't understand the gravity of the situation.
No, that's exactly when I talked to the woman who was 13 years old. Now she's 33. Mm-hmm. It was very emotional for her to talk to me about this, because she was talking about it. And you know, when it first happened, when the first plane hit, you know. Mm-hmm. She said that she was rationalizing as someone fell asleep at the wheel or had a heart attack or something, one off. And then she said when the second plane hit, that's when they knew it was purposeful. Yeah. And she said to me, which I thought was so shocking, was she's like, as a 13-year-old, mm-hmm. this was the first time I realized that people would hurt each other without knowing each other mm-hmm. for reasons that I didn't understand.
Right.
She's like, I had no concept that this was a real thing that we didn't hear about just on television, you know, from TV shows.
Like, I can sympathize with that. Like, it took me many years to really understand what why it happened. You know, it took me a long time. Like, I understood, like, the facts. Like, you hear that.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the actual motivations and the history behind it and everything, it took a long time for me to, like, understand. You just knew the what. You didn't know the why.
Yeah.
And I think with that situation, it's – I mean, you could – kind of goes into the ignorance is bliss category,
yeah.
You know? If you're growing up in something where you don't have preconceived notions or context, you know, you're in elementary school or younger, you don't, this is normal for you, you know, and you don't understand that there was something different.
Yeah.
So if that makes any sense.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so you mentioned that there's a bunch of stuff going on here in Coeur d'Alene and Kootenai County.
Yeah, there's a ton of remembrance ceremonies mm-hmm. that are going to be happening over the weekend. We are going to be covering some of those.
Cool.
So look forward to that.
We'll be covering coverage. The one out in Shoshone. The local firefighters are doing a stair climb in Wallace. I've mentioned that story on the podcast earlier, mm-hmm. but we'll be following those.
Yeah.
There are some nicer events too happening over the weekend as well. I know, what's that thing going on at the fairgrounds? I've heard many people invite me to it that I'm probably not going to. It's like the horses versus motorcycles or something.
Oh, interesting.
Like that.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah. Like that was, it's not necessarily my cup of tea, but it sounds interesting.
And we appreciate all of you first responders out there, not only then, but
yes.
Now. So.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Let's jump into Coeur d'Alene Post Falls Press headlines for Wednesday, September 8th. But first, initial success or total failure. Mad Bomber Brewing Company, located at 9265 North Government Way in Hayden, Idaho, is a veteran-owned and operated business that has been serving North Idaho since 2013. Swing by the brewery to try a freshly tapped Oktoberfest, or the Brett's Oktoberfest, we call it in the taproom, coming in at 26 IBU and 5.6 ABV. That's the bitterness and alcohol content, for those who don't know. This ale features a Munich malt and English yeast, giving it a slightly sweet and earthy finish. I'm a huge fan of Oktoberfest. They're very good.
Okay.
Be sure to check out their special events throughout the week, including trivia on Mondays, all-day happy hour on Tuesdays, open mic night on Wednesdays, discounted growler fills on Thursdays, and live music on Fridays and Saturdays. Mad Bomber Brewing also offers a wide selection of ciders from North Idaho Cider for those who may not want beer. We have a pumpkin spice one coming down the pike. Located near Triple Play, come by and mention the podcast when you order to receive $1 off your first beer. Mad Bomber Brewing, recklessly brewed in Hayden, Idaho. All right, Wednesday, September 8th headlines. First one, COVID crisis hits home. This is by Kane Thornbrew. Surging COVID-19 cases have pushed Kootenai Health and other area hospitals to crisis standards of care for the first time since the pandemic began. It's a day that healthcare workers in North Idaho hoped would never come. The Idaho Department of Health and Welfare announced Tuesday that Panhandle Health District and the Idaho's North Central District entered into crisis standards because of, quote, a massive increase in patients with COVID-19 who require hospitalization. That's due to several factors, the Delta variant, low vaccination rates, and staffing shortages. That means resources are stretched so thin, patients can no longer expect the level of care they would receive under normal circumstances. Quote, care for COVID patients is taking away from care from non-COVID patients, said Dr. Robert Scoggins, Chief of Staff and Medical Director of Critical Care at Kootenai Health. What a title. Quote, it's nothing I've ever experienced in my career. Initially, crisis standards can mean patients are receiving care in a place where they wouldn't otherwise, such as the Kootenai Health classroom that has been converted to a care room for up to 22 patients. In extreme instances, hospital care teams have chosen how to ration resources such as oxygen. Quote, we may have to make hard decisions about who gets what and when, said Jeremy Evans, Kootenai Health's COVID incident commander. Still, COVID-19 vaccines provide strong protection against it. Quote, the one thing that could make a difference is to increase the vaccination rate in our community, COVID Health CEO John Ness said during a Tuesday afternoon press conference. In Idaho, about 40% of people over the age of 12 are fully vaccinated. It's one of the lowest vaccination rates in the country. Since the beginning of the most recent surge, 97% of patients hospitalized for COVID-19 at COVID Health are unvaccinated. I'm going to read that again. 97% of patients hospitalized for COVID-19 at Kootenai Health are unvaccinated. Moving on. Data from IDHW shows the overwhelming majority of people who are dying from COVID-19 are unvaccinated. Infections among unvaccinated people, called breakthrough infections, are rare. Kootenai Health has not admitted a single patient for adverse reactions to COVID-19 vaccine.
It was a dark day.
I'm not even gonna say anything. There's nothing else I can say. Those last 3-4 sentences perfectly sum it up. And if you don't get the vaccine, that's on you.
Yep. On a follow-up to that conversation, we have lawmakers voice their opposition to vaccine mandates. This one's mine, Madison Hardy. A resolution unanimously passed by the Idaho Republican Party is calling for legislative action against forced vaccinations amid a rise in state COVID-19 hospitalizations. By supporting the document, committee members urge Republican lawmakers to, quote, immediately pass legislation that protects Idahoans against coercive vaccine mandates that go against the consciousness of Idahoans. The resolution further prompted state party chairman Tom Luna to issue a formal request for Republican lawmakers to reconvene and take up vaccine mandates. Republican Representative Ron Mendei from Coeur d'Alene affirmed the resolution Tuesday. He said that all health care decisions should be between a patient and a medical provider, not an employer. Mendei said, the Constitution is designed to protect individual liberties and the freedom of liberty. So if you don't want to participate in a vaccine trial program, you don't have to. Recognizing that the COVID-19 pandemic couldn't be, quote, legislated away, Mendei said the virus would likely have to, quote, run its course among the Idaho population. Eventually, Mendei believes the community will reach a natural immunity, which he said is the best immunity. Senator Mary Souza, a Republican from Coeur d'Alene, agreed that individuals shouldn't be required to have, quote, invasive medical procedures against their will. She said, I certainly think if people want to get a vaccine, they should do what works for them. People shouldn't be compelled to do this against their will. It's their body. They should take responsibility for it. Souza applauded the efforts of healthcare workers. However, she questioned if labor shortages and vaccination mandates have left the facilities with a skeleton crew. Quote, some healthcare institutions, especially in the Boise area, have required the vaccine and are threatening loss of jobs. If those people are not part of the workforce anymore, how is that influencing the level of staff? She also said that, quote, I realize people are getting sick with the Delta variant, and it's really too bad, but are healthcare facilities fully staffed? I believe there could be multiple factors at play. Because House lawmakers only went into recess, the body will return to Boise sometime before 2021 ends, and said, instead of a formal adjournment. Both lawmakers anticipate that there would be legislative action addressing forced vaccinations when lawmakers reconvene later this year. Obviously, we have new news today, mm-hmm. or yesterday,
yes.
from President Joe Biden, who issued an executive order requiring vaccination mandates for federal workers, contractors that work with the federal government, and any private employer with over 100 employees. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to see how that...
When does that become implemented? Is that immediate or...
I cannot specifically remember what day it wants to be fully initiated by. I know that OSHA is currently working to see how this would apply. He said that he wanted to really ramp up the amount of tests mm-hmm. that we are producing so that this can happen. Because if I think... I can't remember if it's what... personnel this applies to, but some can opt out to have, you know, testing done week to week.
Sure.
But this is a serious issue that will affect a lot of companies,
yeah.
not only nationwide, but here in Idaho.
Sure.
So we're gonna have to figure out how that works out.
Right. And this definitely goes into like my North, if you're from North Idaho, you're like ingrained with certain libertarian ideals. It seems like it's a strong thing up here. And while it's no secret on the podcast that I'm a full fan of the vaccine and I think everybody should get it, mandates can be tough for me, for anything. It's not, you know, it's not specific to vaccines. It's usually when you try to tell somebody what to do, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that will do the exact opposite just because you're trying to tell them what to do. And it causes issues, and that's how you get disgruntled people, and that's how you can sometimes get government overreach. Mm-hmm. Again, not speaking specifically to vaccines, I'm thinking, you know, anytime these types of things can be implemented on certain things. So I am cautious of this. While I definitely am 100% in agreement with Joe Biden and the administration on people should get vaccinated 100%, I'm totally going for that. I think that, I don't know, it definitely, there is something to my libertarianness from the ingrainedness from North Idaho that it rubs it the wrong way a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I spoke to Post Falls Mayor Ron Jacobson today because we are doing a follow-up on the order by President Biden. And what he said to me really, I think, encompasses it, is that he doesn't believe a mandate will do any good, any more good than it did when they tried to mandate masks.
Agreed.
Because people don't want to be told what to do. You know, I think the best course of action always is education and personal decisions. You know, I also I'm vaccinated. I believe that it has helped me, you know, in a job where I go out and talk to dozens of people a day. It does give provide me personal comfort to think that maybe I won't get them sick and they won't get me sick. So it's definitely something I have chosen for myself. I think that people should have that conversation with their physician. I know some people can't get the vaccine.
Sure. And that's not what we're talking about.
But I think that, you know, people should consider it as a serious benefit to not only themselves, but the community at large.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And that's a very good point as well, because that argument came up during mask mandates is enforceability. Whether you agree or disagree with the mandate or not, there is it realistic? And I think that that also has to be taken into play, because at the end of the day, if you don't have local law enforcement agencies enforcing said mandate, then it's not a mandate. And it has no teeth with it. And the people who don't want to do it are not going to do it. So, there is that side of it. I will sit here and tell you that you need to get a vaccine all day, and I hope I can change your mind. And convince you. In fact, I've had two people that are fairly close to me recently get sick who were anti-vaxxers, and they wish that they did not, or they wish that they did get it. So I definitely, you know, hindsight's 20/20, obviously.
Yep.
But it's a tough issue.
It is.
It's a tough issue, and unfortunately, something that should be just science is now a political issue. If that makes any sense.
It is.
All right, moving down. Thursday, September 9th, recall process underway for trustee. This is by Hannah Neff. The board chair of Lakeland Joint School District Board of Trustees is under process of recall with the notice delivered on Tuesday. Terry Skubitz, organizer of the recall petition group, said they turned over 230 signatures to make sure they had enough for a margin of error to meet the requirement of 198 valid signatures to recall Michelle Thompson. Quote, "I think we've done a good job of raising the issue," Skubitz said. "We've had a lot of people that have connected with us, but I think the effort continues." She said she filed the petition to recall Thompson for what she said was violating board member codes and failing to represent the electorate. Skubitz said she is unhappy with the trustee's performance, including the decision to not renew Superintendent Becky Meyer's contract. Thompson voted not to extend the three-year contract for an additional year in June of 2020. Quote, "I, personally, didn't think it was prudent to extend the most expensive contract the district had during a pandemic when no one else had any guarantee of continued employment," Thompson said. Thompson has 5 business days to resign, or there will be a special vote on the November 2nd election. Thompson said she does not plan to resign. Quote, "I was elected to represent Zone 3, and I plan on continuing to represent Zone 3 until the voters tell me otherwise," Thompson said. "Instead of focusing on the education our children will receive by returning to school 5 days a week, the Save the Lakeland Way's actions are self-serving and pitting the district against the board. If Thompson doesn't resign, the recall will be included on the November 2nd ballot, which will include a statement of reasons for the recall for recall from the petitioners, as well as a rebuttal from Trustee Thompson. For the recall to pass, the majority of the voters must be in favor of the recall and must equal or exceed the votes cast at the last general election for that office." Quote, "SLW seems quite biased and skewed and is creating a divisive environment," Thompson said. Quote, the social media campaign led by a small group of hostile people asking for my removal as trustee is frustrating. As I stated before, I replaced Tim Skubitz, and he and his wife are on a campaign to have me removed. Thompson defeated incumbent Terry Skubitz in the 2019 election for the Lakeland School District district in Zone 3. Terry Skubitz said she and her husband are not planning to run for the trustee seat.
Yep. It's been an ongoing discussion.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to Department of Defense medical personnel arrive at Kootenai Health. This one's by Catherine Brew. The cavalry has arrived to support a staff at Kootenai Health, where surging COVID-19 cases have pushed the hospital to crisis standards of care. But amid the aid of military medical personnel may not be enough if COVID-19 cases continue to climb. For at least 30 days, a team of 20 of the Department of Defense will be on site at CUNY Health, comprised of 14 nurses, 4 physicians, and 2 respiratory therapists. The hospital also expects to receive clinical support this week from an ACI Federal Labor, a government-contracted agency. Dr. Scoggins, Chief of Staff and Medical Director of Critical Care at Kootenai Health, said, "This help could not have come at a better time. Our staff is stretched to the limit." Kootenai Health requested federal aid in early August when 69 patients were hospitalized due to COVID-19. Those numbers have only climbed. 115 people were hospitalized Wednesday, with 40 in critical care. The scarcest resource right now is staff. Quote, "The resources we're bringing in now puts a dent in that, but we're still short," said Jeremy Evans, Kootenai Health's COVID incident manager. Capacity poses another major challenge as COVID cases continue to rise. Kootenai Health normally has 330 beds and operates at about 80% capacity. Yesterday, 218 beds were filled at the hospital, more than half of them occupied by COVID-19 patients. Meanwhile, local nurses are working 12-hour shifts in full PPE and coming into work on their days off. They're sometimes faced with treating people they know personally, whose bodies are ravaged by COVID-19. Quote, "That emotional trauma the nurses see every day wears on them," Scoggins says. "I've never seen anything like this. The coronavirus is different." Most people who contract COVID-19 recover, he said. About 10% of those who catch the virus are hospitalized. Of those, about 3% land in the ICU. At that point, mortality rate rises dramatically. Quote, "Patients in the ICU regret not taking this seriously," Scoggins said.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. It seems like anybody who goes down with a serious case of this, it's not a one size fits all situation. Some people can, even if you're unvaccinated, you're right. Some people get it and feel fine. It happens. I was luckily in that camp when I got it the first time around. I got it. I was tired, lost my sense of smell and taste, but. It certainly didn't knock me out for a while. I wasn't bedridden or anything like that, which it's doing to a lot of people. Some people can't breathe, and that's not a good thing.
Oh. Which leads us into Friday's headline, quote, "We've reached our limit." This one's mine, Madison Hardy. "An emergency meeting Thursday afternoon, county and health officials developed a coordinated COVID-19 response plan to alleviate strain on local facilities. Representatives at the meeting included Kootenai Health, Panhandle Health District, county, state, and emergency service officials. Following the discussion, officials outlined 3 actions. Working with Northwest Specialty Hospital and Kootenai Health Urgent Care Centers to develop tiered dispatching protocols for accepting COVID-19 patients, revamping information graphics and public service announcements to show new measurements, including how many hospital patients are vaccinated and unvaccinated, and setting up an additional field hospital. Sheriff Bob Norris requested the meeting in response to North Idaho Health Facilities activating crisis standards of care. On Thursday, Kootenai Health reported 109 COVID-19 hospitalizations, 37 critical care patients, and 20 required ventilators. Before this surge, Kootenai Health Chief Regional Operations Officer Jeremy Evans said the highest peak hospitalization count was 91. Since the pandemic began in 2020, several waves of COVID-19 have rocked the state. However, Evans said the surge currently flooding North Idaho is, quote, "faster and more aggressive than anything we've seen before." Quote, the Delta variant is more contagious and it results in a much sicker patient population, Evans said. Panhandle Health District Director Don Duffy said approximately 95% of COVID-19 hospitalizations in Idaho are from the unvaccinated. In August, there were 36 deaths in Kootenai County due to COVID-19. Due to slim resources, Kootenai Health, a regional center for outlying hospitals, cannot accept patients typically admitted for treatment. Over the last 3 months, Evans said the number of outside requests for care has escalated from maybe 20 to 392. Kootenai Health operates 26 critical care beds. Some days, Evans said there could be 50 or more patients needing that critical care. On top of this, the oxygen supply for ventilators is wearing thin. Evans fears the situation will worsen following Labor Day weekend, the North Idaho State Fair, and the start of the 2021 school year. Panhandle Health Public Health Preparedness Coordinator Nick Mykonoff said officials anticipate the current surge to peak in October. Quote, they're saying by mid-October there will be 30,000 cases a week and about 5.8% of those are hospitalized, Duffy said. That's for the state. It's much higher than where we were back in November. Officials emphasize the need for vaccinations, masking, and social distancing.
Not much else to say on it.
No.
Covered it so much now. I mean, it's people are going to do it or not.
Just heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. It really is. All right. Is that it for Coeur d'Alene headline?
Yes, it is.
That's all we got. That's all we got. That was a lot, actually. We didn't. I say it like, well, I just blew you straight through it. Real quick, a message from the Shoshone County Fire Chiefs Association. As the hunting season begins, remember to enjoy the outdoors while keeping wildfire safety in your sights. All it takes is one spark or ember from an unattended campfire, muzzle of a gun, or a hot exhaust pipe on a vehicle, trailer, or ATV to ignite a wildfire. Remember, one less spark means one less wildfire. All right, that moves us into Shoshone News Press headlines for Friday, September 10th. Headline: slow speed pursuit ends with one in custody. This is by Chance Watson. A California man was taken into custody Wednesday night after leading law enforcement on a slow speed pursuit down Interstate 90 in a stolen UTV. Probably one of my favorite lines that I've ever written is in this story. We'll get to it. Nat Bush, owner of the side-by-side, explained to the news press that the vehicle was stolen around 5:15 p.m. from his mother's property located roughly 5 miles north of Blue Creek Bay. His mother, who at the time was using the UTV to collect firewood, was the first person to notice the suspect. Quote, "He comes walking out of the woods and he tries to start an old broken-down car we've had for years," Bush said. "Then he goes to an old broken-down golf cart and she realized right then that he was up to no good. Fearing for her safety, she abandoned the UTV and locked herself in her home, then called a neighbor for help. By the time the neighbor arrived, the UTV was gone." Idaho State Police states that the stolen UTV resurfaced not long after it was reported stolen when troopers spotted it traveling on eastbound I-90 near milepost 32. As the chase developed from there, involved vehicles were reportedly traveling at speeds exceeding 45 miles per hour.
Oh.
When the suspect crossed county lines, personnel at the Shoshone County Sheriff's Office, Osborne Police Department, and Pinehurst Police Department would join in on the pursuit. Around the Kingston area, an Osborne officer successfully deployed a spike strip and punctured the UTV's tires, grinding the already slow chase down to an even slower one. With the pursuit now occurring at a calm 10 to 15 miles per hour, law enforcement was successful in boxing out the overworked UTV around milepost 46 and were able to take the suspect into custody without incident around 6:30 p.m. Upon his arrest, the suspect was showing signs of mental instability and was taken to Shoshone Medical Center for an undisclosed reason. Due to the slow speed of the pursuit, eastbound traffic was slowed for a brief time. Bush, who had given the side-by-side to his mother for Mother's Day, was happy to have the vehicle returned. Quote, I was sure it was gone forever. I'm thankful that they caught him. It was some good police work. Thursday morning, Shoshone County jail bookings identify the suspect as David Alexander Samarand, 30, of San Diego, California. Samarand's booking charges include eluding an officer, driving without privileges, and possession of a stolen vehicle. It was also discovered that he has an active felony warrant out of California. I spoke with people who were on the scene, law enforcement officials. Definitely, usually when you have some sort of erratic behavior that doesn't make sense, you immediately go to drugs. And as far as they know, there's no evidence of drug use in this. So somebody just kind of not having it all together, I suppose, happens from time to time. All right, moving on. Next story, time to pony up. This is by Chance Watson and Josh McDonald. I'm going to skip through this story. It's heavy detailed. Lots of heavy details in this, but I'll get to the point. You listeners, you don't worry. After more than 4 years, the legal journey to determine Silver Mountain's resort's value has nearly come to an end. The Shoshone Board of County Commissioners and unanimously approved a motion to finalize the repaying of over $250,000 tax dollars to the resort following an agreement made between the two entities. This payment was authorized due to an overpayment in taxes from the resort through the course of the property evaluation court battle that began in 2017. The BOCC, along with Shoshone County Clerk Tammy Lewis Eberhard, discussed the matter prior to the motion, which included listing off the specific taxing entities that owed Silver Mountain refunds, including the cities of Kellogg and Wardner, the West Shoshone Hospital District, Shoshone County Fire District number 2, Kellogg Joint School District 391, and Shoshone County itself. Of the listed entities, only Shoshone County and KSD 391 still had remaining balances left to pay, with $98,131.80 from the county and $128,020.44 from the school district. This includes money from KSD supplemental levies and from their existing bonds. The levied monies cover the holes left after the state funding is received, which is roughly 28% of Kellogg School District's annual budget. The total, $226,204.24, will be covered by the county money from funds that they have currently, but then in the coming years, those funds will be recuperated by the county and the school district through levies, according to Eberhardt. These monies represent the 2018 and 2019 tax years, with a total reimbursement from all the entities coming in at $396,225.26. Let's just pay it and get it over with, said Commissioner Jay Huber. If we've got it, let's just take care of it. The reimbursement money will come from the regular annual levies from both the county and the school district. Ironically, Silver Mountain will be paying into these levies to cover the cost of their repayment. Right? The whole legal battle first began in July of 2017 when Silver Mountain owner Trig Fortune appealed the county assessor's appraised value of his then newly acquired property, essentially asking the county to lower the value of the property. Shone County Board of Equalization heard Fortune and his lawyer state their case in February of 2018, but ultimately decided to uphold their assessed appraised value. Fortune, who purchased Silver Mountain Resort in October of 2016 from longtime owners Jeldwin Holdings, Inc., argued that the value of Silver Mountain should be based on the $5 million price that he paid to acquire the property. Contrary to the sale price, though, the Shoshone County Assessor assessed Silver Mountain Resort and its associated properties to be worth approximately $22 million. Hmm. Yeah, it's a big gap. These two very different figures set two very different tax rates for the resort to pay. While Jeldwin owned the property, the company paid taxes on the county appraised value of approximately $22 million and never appealed the decision. It was in their best interest to do so because they were trying to sell the property. Moving down, on May 1st, no, I'm sorry, after Shoshone County Board of Equalization decision to uphold Assessor Jerry White's valuation of $22 million, Fortune appealed the state to make their own determination. On May 1st, the Idaho Board of Tax Appeals concluded that their disputed resort properties in total were worth $6,310,000, far south of the county's. Within 10 days, the state's announcement, county representatives decided to appeal that valuation and take the dispute to court. Following months of litigation and delays due to COVID-19 pandemic, an agreement was reached between the two sides that the combined properties were worth approximately $9.2 million on average from 2018 to 2020. This is where it all fits together. Because Silver Mountain continued to pay taxes based on the $22 million figure throughout the legal battle, though, they are now owed a refund from the entities that benefited from those tax funds. As far as how the repayment will affect various entities, Kellogg Mayor Mac Pooler explained that after the lawyers in courtrooms, they simply had no choice but to bite the bullet. Quote, "Since we have gotten involved in this, we have to set aside money in our budgets just in case we lost," he said. "The county is taking the lead on that, but of course it affects us." Silver Mountain Resort General Manager declined to comment on whether or not the resort would consider donating the funds back to the entities or how they felt about the impact of the repayment may have, but is happy that mostly everything with the saga is over. Silver appreciates being able to resolve the 2018-2020 tax issues with the county and looks forward to making improvements to continue serving the community. Lots of money involved, lots of legal minutia and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's just a weird situation where taxing entities are paying money back to a private corporation.
That is a very interesting flip to what we usually see.
Very much so. It's mostly the other way around when the government's asking for more money. Mm. And it makes it even stranger that, like, it's because tax money was already distributed. Like, it went to the Kellogg School District levy, their bond, the fire district number 2. Like, this money was already sent. So now all these entities are now responsible for paying some of this money back, which is, it's just a weird situation.
Yeah, especially since the budget season really has just come to an end. So all of this, all these dollar amounts have been allocated to fund things these districts need to operate over the next year. So it'll be interesting to see how that funnels out.
Yes, absolutely. We've got one more story, actually, from the Shoshone News Press. Museum of North Idaho wants to hear from Shoshone County. This is by myself. As the Museum of North Idaho prepares to enter a new era with a new home, Executive Director Britt Thurman and the rest of the museum board are looking to take the first steps toward revamping what the place has to offer. Quote, "The museum is in a transitional process where we are not only building a new facility that's going to expand the space we have for offerings, but also it's an opportunity to reimagine what role the museum plays in our community," she said. "A large part of determining this new role is determining what the citizens of North Idaho want to see and find important in our history. To do this, the museum has planned a series of Q&A sessions where they hope to draw upon the knowledge of residents, both young and old. Quote, "We are the Museum of North Idaho, and we focus on Kootenai, Shoshone, and Benoit County," Thurman explained. "But we have kind of this reputation over the years of just being a museum of Coeur d'Alene, so we're really looking to change that and broaden the scope of the content we interpret and the programs that we hold." For Shoshone County, the museum will be holding three separate student sessions on Monday, September 13th at Mullen Junior Senior High School at 9.05 a.m., Wallace High School at 10.15 a.m., and Kellogg High at 1 p.m. The Silver Valley Chamber will then host the community meeting at 5 p.m. in the chamber office located at 10 East Station Avenue in Kellogg.
I would love to hear a little bit about North Idaho. Yes.
I'm excited to hear, you know, Shoshone County has, it's hard to look back and think of Shoshone County now as influential in North Idaho. It's not now. I mean, it's a far cry from what it used to be. It used to be the more money was moved through the Silver Valley than any other county at one time, and it was basically what put North Idaho on the map. You know, tourism in Coeur d'Alene would not have developed if people weren't going to the Silver Valley for mining, and it just wouldn't have happened. So, but now that that's very much in the past, it's hard to look back on that and think that, you know, Shoshone County used to have 22, 24,000 people.
Yeah. I always think about that when you bring it up. I'm like, wow, that's crazy.
Literally lost half its population when the mines shut down. Very crazy, right?
Insane.
Yep. All right. That's it for Shoshone News Press headlines. Takes us into the Bonner County Daily Bee out of Sandpoint.
Yeah, we have Wednesday, September 8th headlines. This one is Water Rights Notices Sent to PR Area. This one's by Anissa Keith. The Idaho Department of Water Resources has started notifying property owners in the Priest River area that it's time to submit their water rights claims. The notifications are the first step of the next phase of Idaho's water education process. About 5,000 notices are being sent to property owners. Notices will initially be sent to all property owners within the Basin's 97 area, which includes the Priest River drainage and communities of Coolin and Priest River. Quote, "If you have a water right or you have to file through the water education process, because you're not just establishing a water right, you're establishing where you are in line," Senator Jim Woodward, a Republican from Sagal, said. "It's a good thing for us to establish the priority of water rights and to get it all laid out in court. Water users who receive all of their water from a city, an irrigation district, a water utility district, or a company are not required to file a claim. IDWR officials recommend filing claims sooner than later because it will cost more. It will be more cost effective for all parties involved. Establishing a water right eliminates questions about water rights that might arise in the future," they said. It is expected that up to 9,000 water right claims will be filed in the Clark Fork Pend Oreille River Basin adjudication, according to a press release from Idaho Department of Water Rights or Water Resources.
Okay.
It's probably important as we're starting to look at all these different initiatives, environmental yes. initiatives that are coming up around North Idaho.
So. I just, as two people who work in journalism, election season, and this just popped in my head, like election season is both a very fun time for us mm-hmm. and a very frustrating time for us. Because depending on how many races there are, depending on how many people there are, because everybody deserves and will get a fair shake. You know, everybody gets presented, you know, candidate profiles and all that kind of stuff. It's just a lot of time. It's a lot of effort, a lot of work. But it's something that we enjoy doing because we like informing the public on who their potential leaders might be.
Absolutely.
All right, moving on. Thursday, September 9th. Prater Red 2 fire under control is by Anissa Keith. A fire located 11 miles northeast of Priest River is 100% contained as of Wednesday morning. The Prater Red 2 fire burned 42 acres of Idaho endowment land, and officials said the cause is still under investigation. North Idaho Type 3 team handled control of the area over to West Pend Oreille Fire District on September 8th. Road closures around the fire have been lifted, and containment lines have been rehabilitated. Idaho Department of Lands officials advise travelers and recreators to have caution in the area due to loose fire weekend materials still impacting the landscape and roadways. The Trestle Creek complex burning 4 miles north of Hope is 60% contained as of Wednesday. A Type 3 incident team with the crew of 223 personnel is creating fuel breaks around the fire with heavy equipment. Hand crews are also being used to extinguish spot fires. To find updates on any major wildland fire currently burning in the contiguous United States, go to the Incident Information System website at insaweb.nwcg.gov. noticed some more smoke coming into the area.
I did too. It was,
I don't think it's coming from local fires, but
you know, I'm just ready for fire season being over. Yeah. I don't know about any of you listeners out there, but my lungs are tired of burning.
Tired. I'm really tired of that. Yeah.
All right. Next, we have Rogstad. LOT may help prevent unhealthy lifestyles. This one's by Emily Bonsant. Sandpoint Mayor Shelby Rogstad cited Idaho's COVID-19 surge as a key reason to implement a 1% local option tax for parks and recreation revitalization. According to the Panhandle Health District, Idaho has one of the lowest vaccination rates in the nation. If the state's population was 70% vaccinated, agencies believe the state could have reached herd immunity, Rogstad said. Quote, so I can't imagine how frustrating it must be as a healthcare worker treating people day in and day out. They are watching people die like they've never before in their career, he said, particularly because this is all preventable. Rogstad then explained how a local option tax is relevant at this time. He said he has heard many in the public asking this. Over 650,000 Americans have died of COVID-19. Nearly a million people died last year from premature lifestyle risk factors, Rogstad said. He went on to cite that every year, a million people die of addiction, inactivity, and poor nutrition. Quote, that's an epidemic, but all the headlines right now is COVID, not the million people that died last year from also preventable diseases, Rogstad said. I'm talking about heart disease, the number one killer in America, almost twice as many as COVID. The decision to approve the local option tax, LOT, can encourage that healthy lifestyle in the community, he said. If approved, Rogstad said the LOT is all about providing access to healthy activities to citizens of Sandpoint and Bonner County. In response, Councilman Joel Espero said he has never heard from the public about anybody caring about addictions or suicide. He felt that mental health now comes up not out of concern, but as a push for a tax. Although he agreed with the need for more open space and parks, Espero doesn't believe these projects would necessarily help those who are struggling. Quote, solving mental health struggles comes down to being a parent, being involved, evaluating, hearing, and understanding your children and their fears, Espirito said. That is how, in a big way, more than open space, you're going to change the world of mental health. Rogstad said he firmly believed that this is in the council's best interest to provide and promote community health. There is a second part to this story on Friday.
All right, moving on. Friday, September 10th. Commissioners vote to revise anti-mask mandate. This is by Anissa Keith. Bonner County Commissioners voted Tuesday to revise an anti-mask resolution proposed last week by Commissioner Steve Bradshaw. The revised resolution will be brought before commissioners next Tuesday. The resolution is a preemptive measure prohibiting Bonner County from implementing a mask mandate should one ever be proposed. Quote, I think the mask should be your choice, not somebody else's, Bradshaw said in an interview with the Bee. Your medical decision should not be sent down by somebody forcing you to do it. That should be your option. This is the second week that the resolution has appeared before the commissioners. Last time a vote on the resolution was delayed because one of the three commissioners was not present. Quote, I have a problem with this structurally when I agree with the content. Structurally when I agree with the content, Commissioner Dan McDonald said. Concerns over the wording of the resolution focused on the limits of the commissioners' authority when they can and cannot enforce. Currently, there is no mask mandate imposed for Bonner County. Due to a recent change in state legislation passed this year, counties now have the final say in recommendations made by non-legislative bodies such as the Panhandle Health. Quote, the governor never mandated mask wearing. Panhandle Health mandated mask wearing. Commissioner Jeff Connolly said, if Panhandle Health brings a mask mandate forward or suggests that's what we do, then it comes before us and we have a discussion in front of the public and vote accordingly. McDonald expanded on Connolly's point after the public comment. Quote, if this would have been written a little bit more focused with mask mandates, I probably would support it, he said. It's best and most prudent for elected officials to wait and hear arguments from both sides.
It seems like it's the theme of this podcast, mandates. I almost, because you mentioned businesses a little bit in here too. For some reason, it sits a little better with me if a business puts on their door that like you need to show proof of vaccination to come in. I'm okay with this. Business owners should be, you know, short of, you know, breaking the law kind of thing. In extreme circumstances, I firmly believe that businesses should almost be able to do whatever they want. No shirt, no shoes, no service. If they want to do, you know, please don't enter without a mask. Businesses should be able to do that sort of thing. Now, but when the government gets involved with it as more of a broad thing, again, the libertarian North Idaho-ness, those lights start popping on a little bit. So But as far as a mask mandate goes, I don't want to say we're past it or we're over it, but I feel like at the same time, the issue is now vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And masks are just kind of, honestly, mask usage is popping back up because people aren't getting the vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the majority of people had them, we probably would be still going off of, you know, what we were told 3-4 months ago, that if you got the vaccine, you don't need to mask up.
Yep. I think one thing that was interesting to me that we talked about last week on this story was that one of the commissioners, the one that proposed the anti-mask mandate, is running for governor. And his fellow commissioner posed that the reason that he's putting this forward now is not so much for protection of the citizens, but as a stunt.
Very possible. It definitely seemed like... That's the podcast. We can. It goes back to, you know, when Governor Little was basically gone for like one day, and the lieutenant governor pulled that stuff. It was obviously a political stunt. It obviously wasn't going to last as soon as the governor got back, kind of thing.
Yeah, it kind of like you said earlier, elections can be a really great time or a really bad time,
right.
And it has a lot to do with what show you put on.
Right. And the coverage that we put out is always going to be fair and unbiased and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, it's sometimes when it's just so blatantly obvious where you're trying to score political points, that happens. We'll even get away from vaccines and all that kind of stuff. I remember when it was a hot topic for a while that Idaho was going to pass bans on Sharia law. Okay. Was there ever a realistic scenario where Sharia law was ever going to be implemented in Idaho? No, of course not. But whoever passed it and went through with it probably gained some political points with their base because that was a good thing for them. So that might fall. This might fall into that category as well.
I mean, I don't know now.
What? With Sharia law?
Al-Qaeda, it's coming back. You don't know. You don't really know at this point. I hate to say that.
I don't think that that's going to be a problem.
We'll find out. Mm. All right. 1% LOT to be on November ballot. This one's by Emily Bonsant, the part 2 that we were talking about earlier. After a conscientious debate, contentious debate, Sandpoint City Council voted Wednesday to place a 1% local option tax on the ballot in November. The vote followed a debate of the project being rushed, the proposal's wording, and selection of parks and recreation projects that would be funded by tax. Residents weighed in on how they think the funds should be gathered and spent through a survey that had a record 785 responses, Jennifer Stapleton, city administrator, said. Councilwoman Deb Ruhl questioned whether the survey led the voters in one direction or another. Councilwoman Shannon Sherman echoed Rule's comments, saying it only mentioned parks and recreation projects instead of other options such as infrastructure. She pointed out that the lack of sidewalks, especially near elementary schools, library, and senior center. Stapleton said the reason for the push to approve the LOT for November's ballot would be so that it would qualify the city to have competitive infrastructure dollars coming from the federal level. The city only has a $50,000 budget this year for sidewalk improvement and connectivity. With the cost to implement sidewalks, that doesn't go very far. Parks infrastructure is important, but Sherman advocated for funding to go into sidewalks near the senior center, library, and elementary schools again. Stapleton said if the council did not approve the tax this year, Sandpoint could lose a large amount of infrastructure dollars that would be readily available to them. Survey said that the residents prioritized the use of the LOT funds to go towards City Beach, the Travers Centennial Complex, Sand Creek Watershed Recreational Trails, Lakeview Park, and War Memorial Field. The new improvements identified were included a ice rink at City Beach, mm-hmm. improved pedestrian pathways, and dog parks. Of the survey takers, the main consensus was a maximum of a 7-year tax. By the 7th year, Stapleton said the city projects would collect over $12 million. The council passed 1% local option tax to be put on the November ballot in a 4-1 vote. Ruel voted against the decision, and Councilman John Darling was absent.
Okay. I can talk about ice rinks.
Of course you can.
For those who are unfamiliar, there has been a huge push, I mean, since I was a kid, to try to get an ice rink up in Sandpoint.
Really? It would make sense. It's a resort town in itself.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely a lover of some ice skating.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely. Have you been out to the Ribbon out in Spokane?
I have not.
Okay, let me. I actually, it was such a unique experience for me that maybe this year I'll like rerun it. I wrote like a review of my experience. It was such a weird thing for me. Now wrap your head around this for a second. So I've played hockey 22, 24 years of my life. Every time I've skated, always a flat surface. Mm-hmm. Always. When would you skate on an unflat, you know, a hilly terrain? First time in my life going out to the ribbon, I actually experienced, you know, going downhill and going uphill on ice skates.
That's a workout.
Well, it was a very unique, rollerblades all the time, up and down hills and that kind of thing. But on ice skates, it was a very new experience for me because think about it, always flat, lakes, ice rinks, ponds.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Always flat. So it was a very unique experience for me to like go down, you know, a small incline and like gain speed and, you know, angle like you would for rollerblades. It was a very unique experience. Anyway, it went off on a tangent. Happens on the show from time to time. All right, moving even further north, the Bonner's Ferry Herald headlines for Thursday, September 9th. Idaho Songs Project comes to Bonner's Ferry. This is by Rose Shababy. Born and raised in West Virginia, Gary Eller has a deep love for the historical stories and songs that originated from his home state. He said that they were more than entertainment. They were oral histories that captured the attitudes and perceptions of the time, or of the, quote, view of history from the average person, Eller said. When he moved to southern Idaho in 2004, he started searching out similar stories and songs native to the area. He didn't find much at first, but he was certain they were out there. His assumption turned out to be correct, and the Idaho Songs Project was born. Oh, I kind of like this. Eller collects, interprets, and preserves songs, poems, and stories composed before 1929. A lifelong banjo and guitar player, he produces CDs and interpretive booklets for each project. The Idaho Songs Project now includes over 200 songs. He has traveled through Idaho, collecting information from libraries, museums, and individuals. He looks for pieces that are specific to, quote, the culture of early Idaho. I wonder if there are any old mining songs.
Oh, I bet there's a million.
That would be super cool if we could learn something like that. Now, Eller is coming to North Idaho for his 20th and final project. Through a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, Eller is partnering with the Bonner County Historical Society to host workshops and performances September 15th through 17th. His focus will be, quote, stock handlers of North Idaho. Basically, quote, anything that qualifies as livestock, including horses, cows, goats, sheep, and even camels, which were used during the mining boom days, albeit not with particular success. Eller encourages everyone to look through their family papers and bring whatever they can find to help preserve the history of Idaho. Quote, I can almost guarantee you, in your county, there is a chest or a box with family papers in it that go back over 100 years that will have some poems at least, and probably some songs from the times, he said. But I can't find them if people don't bring them to me. You can learn more about the Idaho Songs Project at www.bonafideidaho.com.
I think this is awesome. I am so excited about it. I love that entire idea, as I think we have expressed as many times. Me and Chance are both history buffs. Mm-hmm. We love it. Mm-hmm. You know, the concept of oral history is such a sincere concept that I think we don't get enough of.
Nope.
You know, I would love to hear these songs. And I think it's a great idea that he's doing it across Idaho.
Listen, further you go back with music and whatnot, not instrumentals, but like when they're spoken word, well, even instrumentals to a degree, it's all about recording history.
Mm-hmm.
That's how oral traditions were passed down.
Absolutely.
And sometimes when you got a catchy lyric, sometimes you just keep singing them. And nowadays, I mean, we still, you know, obviously when I went to school, I also had a spot for military history.
Mm-hmm.
It's a classic cliche of, you know, if it was a good battle, it's remembered in song kind of thing.
Exactly.
So, and when that happens, it's passed down from generation to generation. And, yeah. Because then immediately when I thought of that, I thought of like the fake Irish songs they sing in The Other Guys.
Okay.
Josh is smiling somewhere right now because he knows the song by heart.
Well, even, you know, organizations have like songs, you know, mm-hmm. we have the national anthem, mm-hmm. you know, there's so much history that can be derived from this kind of stuff. So I'm excited to hear this,
and
quite literally.
Children all got pink eye.
All right, and so we're going to move on.
Come on, you've seen the movie, right?
No, but...
You've never seen it with Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell?
Maybe I have. Is it the one where Will Ferrell has, like, the really pretty wife that he Tozer is not pretty.
Yeah. I'm a peacock, Captain. You gotta let me fly.
Oh, my Lord. All right, let's go. City Council gets update on Moy Dam Rehab. This one's Spicy Bros shit, baby. The Moy Dam Spillway Rehab Project was the focal point of Tuesday night's City Council meeting. Concerns over the spillway's deterioration, which led to crumbling, missing chunks of concrete and significant cracking, prompted the project. The original plans for the project were to remove a 4-inch layer of concrete, replacing it with 6 inches of new concrete, City Engineer Mike Klaus said. However, during the rehab process, workers found that there were pockets of rock that didn't have enough cement to hold its concrete together, leaving a 16-inch deep grooves in some places as they chipped away the old concrete. While additional materials and labor were needed, adding about $77,000 to the cost of the project, city officials said it was still within the project budget, the proposed budget. The project is currently about half finished, with the second half scheduled for completion in 2022. Klaus said the deterioration was significant, but that the spillway was stable and the project is a long-term fix to prevent any future issues or deterioration. That is insane, that much concrete. Mm-hmm.
Takes a lot.
Takes a lot.
It does. It very much does. All right. Is that it?
I think we're done.
We are all out of stories, but that was a good episode.
I hope that you guys liked it.
Yes. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Once again, we'd like to thank Hecla Mining Company for sponsoring this episode. To learn more about Hecla Mining Company, please visit heclamining.com. Thanks again for everyone. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Boy, I'm all over the place. We really appreciate it. We honestly really do. We were actually looking at our stats recently, and it shows that with just a little bit of marketing, it seems that it's just growing by word of mouth, because it's been a small pet project that started out with just a few people here at the Coeur d'Alene and Shoshone and B. And it's growing. It's significantly growing, and we're excited that people love it. You know, it's just convenient for you guys to get the news, I guess, and we hope to continue it going forward. If you're interested in the stories we talked about today or the ones we did not, check us out at www.coeurdalenepress.com, shoshonenewspress.com, bonnercanadadaily.com, or thebonnersferryherald.com. If you listen to us on a podcatcher or would like to listen to us on a podcatcher, please subscribe to us or follow us or like us, whichever applies in your case, so you can get every episode as soon as it comes out, and we are listed on a lot of them, a bunch of them, almost all of them, really, except YouTube. And we're going to work on that.
Oh,
We'll get there. What, you don't want to be on video now?
You know, I don't think people want to see my face.
That's be nice to Madison. All right, everybody. Thanks again. And we will see you on, what would that be, Tuesday?
Yep.
On Tuesday. I'm gonna show Madison now the song from the other guys. So now she knows what I'm talking about.
All right. Bye, guys.